trust important in any influencer marketing? Of course, but then it's even more important when you're talking about a product that's so polarizing that remains federally illegal.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of The Influence Factor by The Influencer Marketing Factory. Today with me, we have Scott Jennings, that is the co-founder and the CEO of Pantry Food & Co., and also the owner of Flower Market Delivery. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, brother. Glad to be here.
Fantastic. I have a little bio about you. I'm going to read it through, right, so the people in the first seconds can understand who you are. And then, of course, like, you know, you're going to tell me more about your background. You have such an interesting story. You started from one point, then you're in something different, right? And I'm pretty sure that you can tell us more about your experience so far. But what I have for you is that prior to starting Pantry, right, that is your new business, you spent almost like a decade, right, on Wall Street investing on behalf of, like, you know, great institutions such as, like, in private investors such as Barclays Capital, Morgan Stanley. And during that time in Wall Street, right, you discovered your passion for impact investing. And you fell in love with that, right, with the concept of doing good for society, also while achieving, you know, attractive returns, right? So now you combine this passion for impact investing and also the passion for health and wellness, right? And you are applying that right now in making a positive impact in the cannabis industry. It's an interesting topic, right? It's, for some people, it's a terrible thing. For some others, like, finally, people are understanding it is not such a terrible thing. So again, why don't you tell a bit more after this brief intro about you? Why did such a change, and what did you learn during your journey so far?
Yeah, man. Great intro, and appreciate that. And, you know, growing up in New York City, where you're at, and that background just brings me home. Numbers rule the world. If you don't understand numbers in your personal finances or a business, you know, you're kind of flying blind, right? So I dove into numbers. I majored in finance. I went and worked on Wall Street for a decade, and I learned a lot, right? Managing private money, managing institutional money, trading, being an analyst. But during that time, I was also, you know, in my 20s, and I was owning and operating a bar in New York City as well. You know, I think that everybody can kind of relate in your 20s. You know, it's the invincible 20s. And I didn't really hear anybody tell me that till I was later. But, you know, the risk appetite when you're in your 20s is so high. I felt comfortable burning the candle, Alessandro, right? Like, work 12, 15 hours a day, maybe 16, then go work the bar at night. Maybe you're going home, taking a shower, and going right back to work, right? You can only do that so long, you know, before your body starts sending off signals. And I think, you know, I can go on this, but that was some of the impetus that was saying, hey, you know, your body shouldn't be drinking every night. You shouldn't be getting an hour of sleep. You know, there should be something better. But it was actually, you know, to expand on this a little bit, it was actually luck as well. I was going between New York and London. And if you didn't think New Yorkers drank a lot, go to London, right? And they drink even more. And luck would have it, the big banks were saying, well, what about Los Angeles? You know, can we send you out there? And you get out to Los Angeles, and it's such a vast city that people have to drive everywhere. It's, you know, very opposite to a London or New York. I said, hey, anybody want to get some drinks? And people said, no, you know, we got to drive, right? And so you realized very quickly this shift in your environment having an impact on you. And California started having an impact on me being an active place. You know, it's always sunny. You don't want to be hungover and not going outside. And so, you know, that was some of the impetus. And if I didn't move out here, Alessandra, I don't think I would ever made the change.
Absolutely. I can see that, especially when you say about, like, you know, correctly, in the 20s, like, you feel invincible, right? And you don't really care too much on your day-to-day type of, like, you know, healthy habits. Before we go more in the business side, can you tell me maybe the best thing or the most interesting thing that you learned both on Wall Street and also when you were working, like, you know, owning a bar? Because they're so different, but I'm pretty sure that you were able to learn one main things from both. And what are they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's risk management. I mean, you know, when you're trading a lot of money, one decimal in the wrong place, you've got a big error, you know, and your risk is way off. When you're dealing with a bar and cash and booze, you know, the cash register can be off, you know? So I think that both of those were instilling discipline in me. And it was really an echo of just my father had, you know, instilled discipline in me around the value of the dollar. And, you know, you don't want to be on the trading floor when,
you know, the decimals off, or you put a sell when it should have been a buy, and then everybody's yelling at everybody because the risk is off. And if your risk is off, you don't know if you're going long or short or left or right. And so I think both of those taught me risk management, but I also think both of those taught me relationships, right? You have to build relationships at the bar. You have a lot of vendors. You've got a lot of customers that come in. And on Wall Street, you've got a lot of clients and customers like that as well. So it's numbers, it's risk management. You need that. But you also have to have this, you know, interpersonal connection with your customers, your clients, or you know, the people showing up to the bar.
Were you like natural when it comes to stress management and try to be like, you know, again, as you said, like you might have like anxiety, you know, because of like what happens. And if you make like, you know, you can really mess up a lot. Was it something for you that were like a natural thing? Did you learn in your way? And do you think can be also taught as a thing if it's not like something natural in you?
Yeah, I mean, that question reminds me of, I believe back in the day, they used to think you either knew how to read or you didn't know how to read. Mm-hmm. They did not think that reading was like something that could be taught. I really subscribe to 10,000 hours, right? I think that you should really apply yourself and you can get better at anything you apply yourself. Of course, you're going to have some natural ability, whether it's LeBron James or, you know, something of that nature, or, you know, some people just are really wizards with math and some people have to work much harder at it. But I don't believe in possibilities as far as what you can learn. It may take you longer or shorter, but you can learn it. And what I love about my family, what I love about Wall Street, what I love about New York is there's no kid gloves, you know? And when you're thrown in there, I think that's the best way to learn, but it's the most intense way to learn, right? So you can have a long learning curve over 30 years, or you could be packed in that trading desk, you know, day after day where people are throwing things at you and you've got to adapt, you know, like, and if you don't, there's the door, right? So it was a fast paced environment that required me to work so much harder. And I'd be lying if I said everybody was at the office as long as I was. I just didn't want to make a mistake and I wanted to excel in what I was doing. So I was willing to get there 2 hours before the head trader, right? I was willing to stay those extra hours. And some people weren't. And, you know, dating back to my time, you know, in high school, I worked in construction. So to me, you know, doing manual labor versus sitting at a desk for four more hours, sure, 16 hours a day is a grind. But go out in the hot sun in New York and dig a ditch or work construction. And, you know, there's a much, you know, big contrast there.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, like when someone complained about like sitting in front of a computer all day. Absolutely. Like, you know, brain work, it's a lot of work, but yeah, sometimes physical work can be really like, you know, kill you like during the day, at the end of the evening, like at the evening, like completely, like, you know, completely off, right? You can't really even move, right? So that there is another level. Yeah. And it's also interesting when you say about also like, you know, sort of like customer relationship, like owning the bar, because when I talk sometimes with people that are more in the hospitality, sometimes they become like almost like they get into almost a psychology, right? That type of relationship with their people, and they get to so many like secrets and things that these people don't even tell to their family, but they tell it to someone in the bar, right? And so I think that you really have that, like not just the compassion, but like you really understand about the psychology and behavior of the people, like what happens in their brain. And I'm pretty sure that maybe you use some of them for marketing, I guess, right? And also for the business, right? Because it's so them in their real life, right? Right?
I think that's one of the reasons why going out with a client on Wall Street was kind of a thing, because if you went out and you know, tied one on, you know, you opened up more and you were more vulnerable, right? Now, you know, alcohol is called social lubricant. And when you open up more and you trust more or you're more vulnerable, you can have a deeper connection. I think that's so true. And I think we'll bring this up a couple times throughout this episode is around trust. You know, if you're trading big money for an institution or a personal, or, you know, somebody's going to give you their secrets at the bar, there's got to be a level of trust there. And I think that, you know, that vulnerability and that humanizing of going out and tying one out and saying, I saw you at your worst, you saw me at my worst, you know, we're pretty shit-faced and now we can go back and do some good work. There was a bonding, you know, experience there and trust building for sure.
Jumping from back in the days, like more on top of unhealthy, like type of lifestyle and so on, then you said like, you know what, I want to change this, right? So tell us what are you building right now and why are you building that?
Hey, quick break. This podcast is hosted by
the Influencer Marketing Factory. We are an influencer marketing agency that helps brands and companies engage with Gen Z and millennials on social media. We take care of influencer identification, storytelling, creativity, negotiation, contracting, campaign management, ROI analysis, in-depth reporting, content boosting, and much, much more. Are you interested in learning more? You can find us at theinfluencermarketingfactory.com, or you can Google The Influencer Marketing Factory.
Yeah, so looking at charts and looking at, you know, investments for a long time, you know, you can't ignore technology, right? It's there. We're you know, talking across the country today on video chat, right? But, you know, interesting enough, cannabis was coming online, right? And again, and I wouldn't have saw this if I stayed in New York, because New York is just coming online. You know, California's had a medical program since the late 90s, right? So, you know, having that access out here and seeing that and starting to see policy changes, you know, a product that's been around for hundreds of years is now starting to have change in policy, which will unlock its growth potential, right? Mm-hmm. In addition, I was, you know, I kept my New York hours, so I was still working out at 5 a.m. You know, I'd be off by 3 or something. And I was just developing a much healthier lifestyle, right? Going to the gym 6-7 days a week. And cannabis for me was always a healthier alternative. Like I didn't need to read any research to know this. You know, have enough alcohol and people do really silly things, you know? Have a lot of cannabis and maybe you'll take a nap or maybe you'll want a snack, but you're just, the difference is so vast, right? So while some people wait for research and wait for the government to kind of come about, I didn't need to see that, right? And then not only that, when you take a step back, you know, if you look at entrepreneurship or you look at impact investing, you know, there's so many benefits to this. You're paying taxes, you're hiring people, right? You're what we're still hoping for is getting people out of incarceration for you know, petty crimes like this. And so when you look at the overall landscape, in addition to its medicinal benefits, right? Like when you talk to a mom, that kid is having 200 seizures a month, and then they go to 4 seizures a month on cannabis, and federal government saying it has no medicinal benefits. This is just like, this is that aha moment, you know, and you just don't get a lot of those. You know, when you look around and you invest in a lot of things, there's a lot of investments that are plain and vanilla. And I've done that, municipal bonds for like a toll road or an airport, like not very exciting. But cannabis is something very exciting that can do so much good in such a broad area. And it aligned with me. So I moved from Morgan Stanley to investing in the industry for a while. But what I started to see was we were starting to make some of the same mistakes we made in traditional CPG with poor ingredients and artificial ingredients. And I said, why take something that's good and pair it with candy? You know, that's not the wellness, you know, impact we're looking to have here. And I have a little asthma and I've been around cannabis smokers my whole life. And while the cannabis community sometimes gives you a harsh time about this, about there's no bad side effects to smoking weed, you know? And I was like, look at older people. They do have some lung distress. Like we shouldn't ignore them, right? And this goes back to first principles. Do you need to hear something's bad for research, or can you use your own eyes and ears and say, hey, I know what I'm seeing, right? And so seeing all this, it really inspired me to say, there's an evolution. And we saw it out here too. A lot of cafes, a lot of wellness cafes, they say food is medicine. Now, some people argue with that, but there's there's a growing majority of people that believe food can be very, very medicinal and healthy for you. Then there's a growing majority of people saying cannabis can be medicinal and help you. So if you pair those two together, and both of those are trending, right? Like we're not having more candy, right? We're not consuming less cannabis. People are consuming more cannabis and people are consuming healthier CPG products, healthier alternatives, better for you products, right? So seeing those two trends, I was like, we got to plug those together, right? And plugging those together would help meet the consumer needs and demand for a brand like Pantry. And that's how Pantry was born. And it was, you know, a little selfish for me, Alessandro, you know, I didn't want to go back to candy. I didn't want to combust anymore, but I wasn't going back to Sour Patch Kids. You know, I wanted a whole food, nutritious edible that wasn't going to harm me while getting the benefits of cannabinoids.
And since this is like, again, not just a business for you, but a passion, something that you believe in. Let me ask you this. This is something that I ask to many people who come to the show, and especially entrepreneurs, right? Before then, we dive in more in the business side, the influencer marketing, like, you know, aspects, the marketing itself. Let me ask you this. Since, again, you combine a business with a passion, can you recall, like, a memorable moment at the early stage of your company that was, could be both or one of the two? Could be either something that you had to do in order to, like, survive, right? Especially at the beginning, they're, like, tough times, right, as a business. What did you do? And also, could be, in addition to that, something that enabled you to move to the next level. Mm. So I don't know if you have a story for both of them, but usually it's nice to tell that to other aspiring entrepreneurs that might not know what is behind creating a company. So what is the story for you there?
A lot of these principles or stories, that they overlap, right? Because we are who we surround ourselves with, right? And that's like, you know, you have to be aware of the environment you're in. Right. So when cannabis came about, I was in an environment that was, everybody was going crazy. It was like growth at all costs. Right. And it's like, you wouldn't go buy milk at whatever price, you know, at some point there's a breaking point where you're like, it's not worth it. Right. When we launched, we were in 120 something retailers out here in California. And I went to those stores. I went boots on the ground with my team. I met with these stores. And I think that, like, you know, you hear this sometimes, you have to listen to your gut and your intuition. And so instead of waiting for things to pencil out, Alessandro, I didn't wait for the quarterly report and wait to see it, you know, how much we were spending to how much revenue we were driving. I knew by the, you know, looking at this right away, that we are spending way too much money to acquire revenue. Right. And, you know, it's partly because if the brand next to you is willing to go so steep in the red to acquire that sale, your options are to either try to match them and go as low as they go. Right. And burn into your balance sheet. Or you say you have some integrity with your business and you say, why would I want to spend all that money, you know, say $100 to acquire $10 in revenue? That doesn't make sense. And so, you know, the environment was so strong, Alessandro, because not only were the brands growing at all costs, money was very cheap. So investors like, sales, right? And I always posed the question. I said, well, what about the cost of a sale? Like, you know, right now we're going through a bear market and a correction. And now so many brands and companies are overextended because it only lasts so long where you can pay $100 for 10. And so to me, I think that was a huge moment, and we didn't waste a lot of time. We pivoted very quickly. We started closing down retail accounts. We started focusing on quality over quantity. And this was at a time that everybody said I was wrong. Like, the metric was more accounts. Investors, to look at your business, they'd say you want to be in more accounts. And this is where I was so fortunate to lean on my experience with finance to say, what are you guys doing? That's not a business, you know? So I made those pivots, and I think it really saved me. And I also, quite transparently, we got rid of some marketing agencies around us. You know, I think marketing agencies can tell a great story. And I hadn't been an entrepreneur before, and I was listening to them and I was trusting them. But you're watching the dollars go out and you're saying, what are we building here? You know, I get that all these other metrics matter, but at the end of the day, the balance sheet needs to generate revenue for the expenses it's having. And so I think getting rid of a marketing company, I think pulling out of a lot of retail was really helpful. And then I think what's really helping us survive today, or helped us survive then into us thriving today, is I go back to risk management, right? We managed our capital better than most, right? So most people have raised, I love the stories about, you know, I hate to pick on them, but Flocada out here in California, they raised $300 million, Alessandra, and they're out of business. They're out of business. $300 million gone, right? So it's like, for us, we were more methodical about how we spent money. Right. I thought it was also founder dollars, which I think helped. I think some founders raise outside capital and they're like, oh, burn this capital, you know, see where we go, and it's not my money. Right. And I was like, you know, I treat their money like it's my money. And I said, we need to continue to test and figure this out. We need to continue to pivot. And I have a very smart investor and advisor and good friend of mine, Jonathan Tufano, and he's in my ear and he's saying, Scott, this already happened in traditional CPG, right? Which was the squeeze. It was Lord and Taylor's. It was Neiman Marcus. Like, brands wanted to get to the customer, but they were squeezing the brands where it was like, there's no margin left over, right? You're not in control. And that's what inspired brands to go direct to the consumer in the first place. And so while you couldn't really see how to get there, I knew I had to minimize my exposure to these high risk counterparty retailers. And I needed to maximize my exposure with the end consumer. And it led me to a very long journey to hire developers and build out software and then launch, you know, or acquire and restructure Flower Market, which is now our online marketplace that allows us and other brands to tell our story and communicate that to the customer so that we can get a fair value for our products that we offer instead of racing to the bottom where nobody makes any money and it ends up in a lot of people being out of business.
I also been saying this for many years, to be honest, that doesn't make sense sometimes just because you want to get, like, you know, piece of the cake and try to become the target, like, you know, the leader of an industry, to really spend, like, your customer acquisition cost, like, it's so high, your revenue compared like to that is so little. If you are not really good in retention, the lifetime value associated to that customer acquisition cost, the ratio goes really down, doesn't make sense. But before, like, all, like, before that, you know, the due diligence were like so almost a joke for some companies. So, like, they were just giving away money. And I think that now, after what is happening to the markets and everything that is crashing and everything, I think that it's time finally that they're realizing that cash is king. Being able to really manage your cash flow becomes super important. And then, yes, like, if you have funder money, like, you know, if you're bootstrapped, you really, anytime there is like a dollar to spend, you think it twice, three times, right? Like, because it's not someone else's money. It's your money, totally. Right? So 100%.
And, let me add one more thing there. So I also posed the question, right? Everybody's tightening the belt right now. And my wife's a health coach, right? So, you know, why we talk a lot about health here and we say, why wait for the new year to try to lose 50 pounds? If you work at it throughout the whole 12 months, maybe in the new year you have 2 pounds to lose, not 50, right? And I think that, you know, some of the commentary I've heard is like, well, no CEO got it right. You know, everybody was overextending. And I said, come on, you know, is that just what the story we're telling us ourselves? Is that just what we're looking at? There's definitely disciplined entrepreneurs out there, but they're rarely the ones that get the splashy headlines about the big raise and the exciting stuff, because they're just focused on, you know, a sustainable growth and tightening the belt much early on. And so I pose that because I do think it's rare to find people that have tightened the belt even when money was you know, free or plentiful. But I do believe that there are entrepreneurs and there are individuals that just because you can eat whatever you want or have as much money as you can have doesn't mean you'll eat everything or spend it all. So
and I think that things are slowly changing, right? I can see it from like, you know, from the markets, but also, like, you know, looking at what is happening in the conversation online, that and in my opinion, hopefully to change for the best, because this has to change. It exploded and it was already on, in my opinion, like, really nonsense sometimes. So likely we will see what happened there. But I wanted to ask you, since we were talking about, like, also what does it mean to manage things by yourself with your money and so on. In the cannabis industry, we all know, or at least if you're in the marketing, right, you know that it's difficult to market because social media don't like you. You have to look at anything from imagery that you use, video. How do you present things, the wording around cannabis? So let me ask you this, and then we're going to go more, since, like, you know, this is a podcast about, like, you know, influencer marketing and the creator economy. We're going to go more in how you also use, like, content creators and so on. But even a step back, how do you navigate the cannabis industry, like, you know, and marketing together? How was it? I don't think it was easy from day one. So how did you, and how do you still manage it? Like, what is the situation now?
Well, the situation at the beginning was I didn't really know, you know, to be honest, Alessandro. Mm-hmm. I mean, you knew on a high level, right? But there's so many levels you can dig into, right? And so, you know, it's been a big learning exercise, right? It really has. And that's part of what I love about entrepreneurship, because you're the crash course in an MBA, you know, class. There's no MBAs that can teach you, you know, the landscape of marketing in cannabis right now, you know, and some companies went and hired marketing executives from Starbucks and they came over, but all their ideas didn't work either, because it's a very unique landscape, right? And again, I would say that what I take from my investing days and I applied here is, like, the best investments you're making are all the no's you say, right? All the money you save, right? So we had to start getting good at saying no, you know, to marketing. Or I had another partner and small investor, and he said, always test and optimize. And that was just so smart, right? Like, always start small, test and optimize, right? You need to find success before you scale it out. And so that led us to be a little bit more a tougher client for all the marketing agencies, because you get all this inbound, right? Do a billboard. Like, it was crazy. These guys are saying, throw a billboard up. You know, a dispensary's telling me, pay for a DJ in the dispensary for $5,000, you know? And it's like, you're hearing all these crazy ideas and you're sitting back and you're saying, okay, I hear you. Let me try that. Let me test that. But as I kept going, I got better and better at my due diligence, right? And one of the questions now that not a lot of agencies like for me is, like, cool, I want to talk to your current clients. I want to hear about their success directly. I don't want any of your marketing material. It doesn't mean anything to me. I want to look at the other companies and I want to talk founder to founder with them. And I want them to say, I work with Alessandro. These guys really care. They're delivering the value. That's not marketing, right? And it's kind of influencer marketing, right? To an extent, you're going to them to influence my decision, but it's a very good vetting question. And a lot of agencies don't like that, because a lot of agencies work in turn and burn. And then I would say, you know, you apply a lot of logic tests, right? Like, one of the logic tests I always use, Alessandro, is like, what did I buy and how did I get there? What did you buy and how'd you get there? What did the wife buy and how'd you get there? And never did I come back and say it was the billboard, you know? Never did I say the DJ influenced my liquor decision at the liquor store to you know, buy this versus that, right? So if I rank for it today and I do my maintenance with Google, you know, to make sure I stay there, I'm going to see a lower cost per click into the future, which will then hopefully impact my customer acquisition cost, reducing that. That, to me, is what you want. You want to be investing to reduce your cost of acquisition, not transacting just to buy revenue. So SEO has really worked. But then it's been content creators. And we've been very, very focused on content creators and influencer marketing. We've been doing it for 4 years. That's been a bigger learning than success. But it's our top two channels. SEO and influencer marketing we're laser focused. You know, some people say you need to hire everything and do everything. You know, you got to be on garbage cans and billboards. I don't subscribe to that, you know, of more focus.
You're doing the 80-20, right? The Pareto principle, right? Like, you know, the 80%, like, came from the, like, 20% are doing, like, two channels, right, in this case, right? And then it's beginning the majority. And yeah, also because you don't lose focus, right? So how many, you are not saying about content creators, how many, do you know more or less how many do you work, like, with? How many do you engage with for your campaigns in the past 4 years?
Yeah. I mean, it's over 4,000. So, you know, when you want to learn something, it's best to do it firsthand, right? When you know, I did construction, right? So when I hire a plumber, I'm not a plumber, but I have some understanding to make sure I don't get ripped off, right? So we really want to do influencer marketing in the house because we wanted to own a relationship. And one of the research pieces I read was, like, owning the relationship is a moat, right? Like, anybody can launch a brand, not in cannabis, anybody can launch an ad, or you can launch a programmatic ad, but building the relationship with content creators takes time. It takes effort, right? So that was a defensibility early investment we made. And we built a relationship with over 4,000 influencers, content creators, very small to some that are very big. You know, we were fortunate enough to do private dinners for the Kardashians and do an activation for Miley Cyrus. So it was, like, all the way up there to, like, you know, a very local 2,000, you know, follower account that just had really high engagement. And we had a lot of learnings from that. One of the learnings was it takes a lot of money to manage those relationships because it's you know, it's time intensive. Oh, yeah. And they're authentic. We're authentic. You can't just phone them up once in a while and try to turn magic on. So we've got a big list, but I think now that we know so much, we also know that it's not our skill set, right? So mm-hmm. we'd rather go back to working with an agency, but we want to find the right partner.
Absolutely. And when you say, like, you know, 4,000, first of all, it's a lot, you know, like it depends by your focus, but I can see that it's like, you know, one of your main channels, because what I saw in the past working in this industry for a long time now, it is that either like a company invests a lot in influencers and, you know, you believe in them and then you go into this cycle where you optimize, or some companies make the mistake to invest maybe a lot of money or maybe like a normal amount of money on a few of them. It didn't work out because when you do it in-house, sometimes you don't know what you're doing. You get like, you know, completely a disaster campaign and you're like, oh, you know what? Influencer marketing doesn't work. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. Maybe you didn't like, you know, do the right steps. So I appreciate that you did like with so many, because you must have a lot of data in your backend to understand the different metrics that matters, right? So not just vanity metrics, but the real ROI associated to that. But I'm also pretty sure that in your industry, what it is important, it is that you cannot just work with any lifestyle influencer mm-hmm. or content creator. You need to want to be associated with authority in the space, mm-hmm. right? So not just like the person that, you know, like get like, you know, edibles and everything, but someone that can talk on behalf of the company and is someone that it is trusted, like to go back what we were saying at the beginning, the trust, right? Can you tell me more about the trust and the authority in your space? And also, how do you find influencers that can be really seen as someone that knows what they're talking about and not just a random person on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, whatever, that talks about your product?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing you have to do is know where we're coming from. So the quick history lesson, 70 years of propaganda has destroyed trust, right? So mm-hmm. is trust important in any influencer marketing? Of course, but then it's even more important when you're talking about a product that's so polarizing that remains federally illegal. However, full transparency, Alessandro, did I really know what I was doing early on? Like, I trusted these agencies and I trusted what we were building internally. And what we wanted to do was seed a lot of different people to kind of get their you know, see the data, see how it worked, right? And we did that, right? Some worked, some didn't work. But back to your statement a second ago, like, you know, some people go to the gym for a week and they're like, I didn't lose any weight. You know, yeah. This channel is already, by first principle, it works, right? We know it works. Right? Like Mr. B's, Kardashians, like on and on and on. We know it works. It's just about finding the right way to execute it, right? So for me, I kept learning and I kept educating and I kept connecting with others. And what we started to realize was, and this also came from Dr. James Richardson, who wrote, you know, Ramping Your Brand, great, great book, which is that also when you're talking about premium CPG, what you are going to put in your pantry, Alessandro, and what you're going to put in your body, there's an even higher trust barrier to that as well. So when you take cannabis being 70 years, you know, polarized, and then you take premium CPG and you say, okay, we really need to dive into that trust bucket. Like that's got to be premier, right? And early on, we were giving it to influencers that were smoking a joint and then, hey, healthy edibles. There's no trust there. You know, So we came up with a rule. Our customer doesn't smoke at all. Our customer values their lungs. They don't smoke at all. And they want, you know, they want a healthy edible and they're looking for the health benefits. They're not chasing a high and they're not smoking a bunch of different random flower, right? Leaning into that more, we knew that they had to be authentic, right? And you're not authentic if you're recommending everything. Like if I came on here and I was like, you know, if I sold advertising all over me, you'd be like, you know, Scott, what do you stand for? I don't know, Budweiser here and lotion here, right? So it's like a lot of brands can, a lot of content creators, influencers can dilute their audience. So then it's looking at them and saying, how many brand deals have they done? How have they performed? How was the content? Was it authentic, you know? And so we started looking at that and we've just been learning a tremendous amount and we're getting so close to activating our next phase of high trust, high credential, right? So like somebody that only talks about sleep, that's it, nothing else, right? somebody that is through and through a keto wellness influencer or vegan, right? Or somebody that's talking about functional mushrooms. Like, we need them to not be even remotely wide, right? We need them to own their niche, right? And that's even how the algorithms are written. You know, we learn from people at Facebook when we were trying to get our accounts back, they dropped some nuggets on us. They said, you know, the Facebook algorithm's confused. Pantry's doing catering, and then you're talking about sleep, and then you're talking about cannabis, and it's like, it doesn't know how to rank you, right? And I think that's the same thing working with a content creator or influencer. If you have strong authority within your vertical, you can convert the people on that. But if you're talking about various different things, people are going to look at you and your trust is going to go down, and all these things have an inverse relationship with each other. So I'm not saying I have it perfect, but we're very, very close and we've learned a tremendous amount.
It's interesting when you said about, you know, really do your homework and identify what want to be like, you know, the influencer that you want to involve in. Because as in the, you know, typical, like, you know, body books, when you do marketing, you have to find what is called the marketing persona, right? For everyone out there that is listening today might not be that familiar with the term, right? But anytime that you go out there, you want to be sure that you can understand the clusters of the people, what is your demographic. And I noticed that, you know what, sometimes companies don't do that. Sometimes you ask to new companies, like, who is your typical customer? They don't know. And the same question, like, who is your typical, like, influencer? They don't know. So I think that doing the homework before even starting to look for them, to identify, as you correctly said, like, you know, these, we only want to work with these parameters. We want to be sure that the trust is there, the authority is there. We don't want to have, like, if they are these, they are disqualified. These are the criteria. And even, like, doing a thing, this is, like, my advice for every, especially, like, you know, new companies out there, medium companies, even the big ones. As you do the marketing persona, also think about the influencer persona, right? Who are they? Do a matrix, create a framework, whatever. But if you do not identify even, like, the first step, then it's going to be really chaotic when you go and use a platform, whatever you want to use, an agency, right? Because if you don't know who you are looking for, it's going to be difficult for an agency to understand that and help you out. It's going to be difficult for your marketer in the company to go out there, right? So I think that what you said, it's absolutely important, and not many companies still understand the importance of create a framework, something like even just a grid out there, a Google file, whatever it is, right? To go out there and identify the people.
Right? It's evolving. Like, when we were young, when we were dating, did we know who we wanted? You know, like, you learn. Right. So you have a base framework. Don't go into it blind. You know, have that base framework, but be able to test and take the feedback in and evolve your understanding of what your persona is. Right. Like, we thought our persona was chefs. Right. Because we had an infused olive oil and we thought we wanted to lean on the credibility of chefs. But through testing a lot of that, we noticed that, you know, chefs show off a lot of food, but maybe they don't have as much authority, you know, on a CPG product or telling you what to buy, right? So I think, yes, to your point, have a foundation, but also be willing to test and learn and evolve on that, because I think sometimes people either don't get started because they don't know, or they get started and it's too loose and too messy.
100%. And I mean, it's, I said this also in other episodes, it's still new as a concept. And if you look at the story, right, of influencer marketing and content creators and the creator economy, it's so new. And there is so much of, like, you know, room of improvement from everyone involved. And I think that is still, I say this all the time, I see, like, kind of the infancy on some terms, right? It's evolving, but for certain things, still at the beginning. So absolutely. And is there anything, Scott, that I didn't ask you today that are either excited about, anything that you are working on, or something that I just, like, didn't ask you that you would like to share with the others? Could be something, could be nothing. I don't want you to press on anything if there is, but I want to just check before we start wrapping up.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the why. You know, what I'm so excited about is helping people, Alessandro. You know, I mean, I evolved and I didn't believe that just making money is good enough. You know, you have to have a higher purpose in life. You have to have a passion. And, you know, our North Star is to help people. And I think that, you know, some of that has been blocked by retailers wanting to, you know, just sell cannabis to recreational consumers and get them, you know, that are chasing a high. For us, we have so much feedback. I have a box under my desk of letters and emails and, like, people saying, wow, this helped me. Wow, this improved my life. Like, that is really energizing to me. And, you know, one of the products we're in development right now is how to use cannabinoids and Ayurvedic medicine from India to help with PMS and period relief, right? And like, who's doing that, right? These are age-old problems that are massive problems that maybe the current solutions in market aren't helping. So what I get so excited about is helping consumers. And we know we have great products. We've got all that research and all that feedback. We now, through Flower Market, can reach 30 million customers in California. And now we want to leverage the trust of content creators to try to get more people in the industry. Try get them to try it. When somebody tries it, they're writing back like, wow, I feel so much better. I thought this was, you know, a drug. I thought it was this. And this just goes back to content creators, influencers have been building trust for years. And we want to leverage that trust. And we're so excited to do so because so many of our peer companies thought that a billboard would convince you to try cannabis and that because you're top of mind, you're going to try it. But it goes back to that trust word. 70 years of stigma, people are more concerned than ever about what they're putting in their body. You need maximum trust to try to get somebody to convert and try cannabis, especially if it's a little bit more expensive with the taxes and the regulations out here. So I think that's just what we're really excited about. Our next stage, which is going from helping thousands of customers to helping hundreds of thousands of customers. And that, to me, gets me all fired up.
I love it. Thank you for sharing the why, the reasoning, and more about your business, what you're building, your experience in the past. So again, really, thank you, Scott, so much again for joining the show today. This was The Influence Factor by The Influencer Marketing Factory, and I'll see you next week.
Thank you, brother.